You have a lot of personal memories of Pope John Paul II, don't
True.
You? You
Yes.
worked with him extensively, but you were
Yes.
also ordained by him, is
I was
that right?
ordained bishop by him on the 6th of January 1992, which was a great privilege. He had appointed me bishop. I remained secretary of the Council for Interreligious Dialogue, where I'd been appointed in 1987. And so from 1987 until the death of John Paul II, we'd been working very closely together. I would say he was really our inspiration for interreligious dialogue, for relations with people of other religions.
Why do you think it was such a priority for him?
You know, I think this comes from his youth and his growing up and his contact with the Jewish people, with his Jewish friends. And this is an experience that he had, that in a very Catholic country, but under communist rule, but being open at the same time to people of other religions who had no intention of becoming Christians and who had perhaps a hard time in Poland. And I think that must have, you know, marked him. And when he became a pope, right from the very beginning of his Redemptor Hominis, his first encyclical, he opens the perspective of relations with people of other religions, that the mission of the church is to all people, to all people. It's the continuation of the incarnation, and Jesus has come to save all. And that doesn't necessarily mean, because according to the teachings of the Vatican Council, that all have to become Christians. No one could accuse John Paul II of being an unfervent Christian, and he was a missionary for the church. But at the same time, he had this great respect for people of other religions, and they returned that respect. You know, I came in, just to continue, I came into the work in the Council for Interreligious Dialogue just after Assisi, and that had a terrific impact. You know, there was the abbot of the oldest monastery, Buddhist monastery in Japan, who'd come for that meeting in Assisi in 86, Etai Yamada. He was so impressed that he said, we must do the same. And every year since then, in Mount Hiei, the sacred mountain in Japan, they have had a meeting of interreligious leaders for praying for peace, you know, and with the same spirit as John Paul II.
Is it fair to say that it really changed or marked an important turning point in the church's attitude to interreligious dialogue?
I don't know that it completely changed, but it certainly encouraged people around the world. There were many different initiatives, not only from the Vatican, but also, as I said, from people of other religions and the local churches around the world, who I think were encouraged by this vision of the Pope, who is together with other religious leaders for a purpose, for the sake of humanity. And I think that is, as John Paul II himself said, we are on a common pilgrimage, we're journeying together. And it's that spirit, I think, that carried people forward.
Can you recount to us one or two personal anecdotes, one or two striking memories of him as a person? Because it was also this incredible personality, wasn't it, that so attracted people of other faiths?
Well, yes. I would say my first meeting with him was a week after I was appointed. I was invited to supper. The Pope had appointed me. He didn't know me, and I suppose he wanted to see who this person was. So he met me and he looked at me and found me a bit young, but anyway, that I always look younger than I am. And we went and prayed in the chapel. Then we went to table and he had a book with him, a book on Islam, which he brought and showed and put it on the table. And then he started asking questions about Islam. There was no way of saying, oh, Holy Father, you know much better than I do. You have to answer, you know. And I think there was a humble side to John Paul II too, that to be able to ask the or use the expertise of other people. And I must say, he put me completely at ease. There were just the four of us, the two secretaries, the Pope and myself, and we just conversed, you know. And that was, I think, typical of him to ask questions. Every time we went after that to report on our work, which was usually over a working lunch, it would be the same. We would report on what we were doing, Cardinal Arinze and myself and perhaps the Undersecretary as well. And the Pope would go down. We prepared a list of things and he would go down, and sometimes he would return and ask a question. Very rarely did he make any pronouncement, but he was taking it all in. He had this capacity to listen. Another little anecdote that I would like to recall is in the Jubilee of 2000, I was told by Cardinal Ray, "You're going to be there on the 5th of November, aren't you?" I said, "Well, what's on the 5th of November?" "It's the Jubilee of the Politicians, and Thomas More is going to be proclaimed the patron of the politicians. You have to be there." I said, "OK, I'll be there." And there was a delegation that came out from England and Wales, and so I put myself with them, with Cardinal Murphy O'Connor and the other bishops who'd come out. And at the end of the Mass, Cardinal Murphy O'Connor and the delegation went up to greet the Pope, so I went with them. And I was the last one. And Cardinal Murphy O'Connor was introducing each bishop, and when it came to me, he said, "This is Bishop Fitzgerald." The Pope said, "He's one of ours." Which I was very chuffed, you know, because I felt, yes, you know, he's one of our people.
Part of the English delegation is also very much a Vatican.
Yes, and it's this friendliness, this sense of humour of the Pope also. We had a Mass with him for the 25th anniversary of our dicastery, of the Council for Interreligious Dialogue, and afterwards he was greeting everyone and he said, "I wish you gaudium magnum, you know, great joy in your work," which is, you know, something that carried us forward. You could see as he was declining in health, you could see, but he was still continuing, and he gave this example. Another little story. After the day of prayer in Assisi in 2002, after the events of 9/11, he invited the delegations from other churches and other religions to lunch in the Vatican the following day. Some had gone already because of the invitation came late, but there were some who were there, and there was a Sikh at my table, and the Sikh said, "I have a message for the Holy Father." And so he wrote the message, and he said, "Holy Father, you have been a father to us, not only a father to us, but a mother. You have given us spiritual food and material food. We love you." I didn't have to give this little BA to the Pope, because the Pope received every guest. He wasn't well, but every guest afterwards was able to meet him. So the Sikh was able to say this to himself directly.
Very moving moments for you. We're looking ahead to Assisi, the 25th anniversary in October this year. Is it such a priority, do you think, under this pontificate? What are our expectations for this anniversary?
I think that Pope Benedict has put in, I would say, three priorities. One is religious liberty in the world, and that is religious liberty not only for Christians, of course that is a priority too, but it's for all people to be able to practice their religion, to be able to change religion, to have full, not just freedom of worship, but full religious freedom, freedom to teach, freedom to propagate, etc. That's one. I think the second is his insistence on faith and reason. So that for us Christians, that our faith will be enlightened, if you like, by reason, but reason can also be enlightened and strengthened by faith. And that goes also for other religions. He has said explicitly in offering dialogue or proposing dialogue to Muslims, he has proposed this theme of faith and reason. And then following on from that, I think it's the place of religion in society, that society, secular society, shouldn't be afraid of religion, and religion should know that it has something to contribute to society today, but also respecting the civil authorities, not trying to take the place of civil authorities. And I think that that is the spirit in which this commemoration of Assisi 25th anniversary will take place, probably, because I think he has opened it up to all people of goodwill, and it's with the perspective of, you know, working together, committing ourselves together for peace and prosperity for the whole of humanity. So it's this universal outlook which is kept, as Pope John Paul II had. It's widened out to people of all goodwill, even if they're not believers. Whether that will make some of the believers hesitate to come or not, I don't know. Who will actually come, we'll have to see. But I think this is the perspective. And it's, again, as in 2002, it's a pilgrimage for peace. The peace train will go from the Vatican again, which was a good experience in 2002. And it's not so much an emphasis on prayer, but on common commitment for peace, I think.
There have been many difficulties, though, in the dialogue, particularly with Islam recently. And if we look at the dialogue with Al-Azhar there in Cairo, where you are, suspended earlier this year because of comments made by the Pope, how likely is it that we will see a resumption in the near future?
I can't say, really. I would hope that there will be a resumption of dialogue, but I really don't know whether there will be any change of heart or any steps taken that will bring about a change.
What is needed, do you think?
I think there's needed is greater understanding on perhaps on both sides. Pope Benedict has a disadvantage in that his predecessor, Pope John Paul, was highly respected all around the world, and his visit to Cairo in 2000, his visit to Al-Azhar was immensely successful. They were really happy with that visit. And Pope Benedict is perceived as being less open and less respectful of Islam, which is not true. But, you know, from the Regensburg speech, which this offended Muslims, and they don't feel that the Pope has made sufficient amends for that. And yet he has said and he has shown in many ways that he does respect Islam, and that I think the journey to Turkey was very important in that line. But it's hard to convince people. They always feel that there's something there that is not favourable to them.
What can you do in your role there as nuncio? How much can perhaps ongoing relations help to break this mistrust?
Well, I've tried. And recently I met with the imam, with Sheikh Al-Azhar, but there wasn't any progress at that meeting. What I did say at the end was, even if there is no dialogue with the Holy See, that's only one part of the dialogue, I would hope that dialogue will continue with the Christians in Egypt, not only with the Orthodox Christians, but the Coptic Orthodox, but also with the Catholics there, who do have a role, though they're very small in number, but through the network of schools and the social action that the church is carrying out, it is important. And it seemed to me that the Sheikh agreed with that. So let's hope that the dialogue, at least at the local level, will continue.
Continues to be very difficult, doesn't it, for the Christian population there, particularly in the wake of the violent attacks earlier this year?
There was a great movement of solidarity between Christians and Muslims after the bombing of the church in Alexandria on New Year's Day. What is happening at the moment is that with a greater freedom in Egypt, the more, let's say, fundamentalist-minded Muslims are showing their might, their will to dominate. And this has been very upsetting, I think, for Christians. So in certain areas, the Salafiyin, those who have a very strict understanding of Islam, are trying to impose their will on a whole area of society. And this is very difficult. But there are other Christians and Muslims who are working together for a more open society, a civil society. And we hope that they will, you know, maintain their courage and move forward together towards the elections in September, which will be extremely important, of course, because from that, the people who are elected to the parliament, they will choose members for the Constitutional Assembly, who have to then draft a new constitution.
There are a lot of concerns at the moment in the wake of the assassination of Osama bin Laden about renewed ferment, particularly in fundamentalist circles. Do you think this may have an effect on Egypt?
I don't know about that, really. Of course, there are elements in Egyptian society that are in contact with the Al-Qaeda movement.
Some of the leaders, in fact.
Well, some of the leaders are Egyptians, yes. I don't think that the death of bin Laden will end al-Qaeda activities. That's my own personal feeling, because I think it's more of a conglomerate of people rather than necessarily an organized movement. We have to wait and see. Let us hope that there will not be other attacks, bombs, violence. It's very bad for the country because of the country depends heavily on tourism, and if there are bombs, the tourists don't come. At the moment, I would say it's quite safe, and I don't think that anybody could come to Egypt, as far as I could see. But we have the economy is not in a very good way, and so we have to work on that, and we just hope that the army who are in power at the moment will have sufficient strength to stamp out any violent attacks.
Egypt has also been very involved, hasn't it, in brokering reconciliation between Hamas and Fatah in an attempt to try and resolve the wider Middle East conflict.
Yes, Egypt has always offered its good offices for the reconciliation, and they are to sign an agreement which has already been agreed upon, and they've ticked off the paragraphs, the people who are negotiating, and now it's for the leaders to sign. Egypt is very happy with having been able to do that.
Is it a sign of hope? Can it be a real step forward, do you think?
Personally, I think so. As you've seen, the official reactions on the other side have not at all been favourable. But I think if you want to make peace with a people, you have to make peace with the whole people and not just with part of the people. So if the people are uniting themselves, but maybe there has to be a modification also of the position on the Palestinian side to allow this peace with Israel. But we need this peace, and everybody needs this peace, and then the Palestinians and the Israelis need this peace. So let us hope let's hope that John Paul can, from above, will be able to contribute to this.